Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. One of the people who is a champion in that war, has been for many years, is our first guest. She is Nina Shea. She is currently the director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute here in Washington, D.C. She has served with distinction as a member of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and is the co-author of a marvelous new book, Persecuted, The Global Assault on Christians. Nina Shea, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Frank, for having me on.
Congratulations on the new book. I have not had a chance to see it, but I've been hearing a lot about it, and it sounds as though it's a very timely warning to all of us, really, Christians and non-Christians, as to what is happening, kind of canaries in the mineshaft, if you will, at the hands of Islamists and others around the world. Give us sort of your overview as to what is happening to these minority populations, in many cases, in the Arab world and elsewhere.
Well, thanks, Frank. The book is out this month. It's called Persecuted, and it documents and give stories, breathe life into the experience of these Christians around the world who are persecuted for religious reasons. And persecuted is, you know, very severe treatment, torture, imprisonment, death. It documents how Christians are the most persecuted religious group that has been already established by sources such as the Pew Research Center and The Economist, even Commentary Magazine and Newsweek. So we look into the kinds of situations that cause this persecution. And there are three types. One is the communist and remnant communist regimes, which are militantly atheistic, of course.
Mm-hmm. And notably Korea, communist China and North Korea. Right.
And then there's the most widespread and growing form of persecution, and that is coming out of Islamism in the Muslim world. And then there's the regimes like Burma and India that India is a democracy, but may have nationalist reasons for suppressing and persecuting its minorities, including Christians.
And Nina, to the extent that this has been happening, you mentioned that it manifests itself in a lot of different ways, churches being attacked and the people inside them maimed or killed, people losing their jobs, people being driven from their homes or their countries, in some cases being murdered outright. To the extent that this is happening, to what extent do you find government involvement in these various nations where such attacks are being perpetrated?
Well, it's very common in the Muslim world, for example, to have government involvement in legislation that will suppress them, will prevent them from having marriages, building churches, worshiping in public. You know, Saudi Arabia, for example, and Iran both put to death people who convert to Christianity. Saudi Arabia doesn't allow any churches whatsoever. Egypt, you know, has banned building of new churches. The government of Sudan will bulldoze churches. So Pakistan has laws against blasphemy, which are used to disproportionately target Christians and disadvantage them by establishing courts where Christians' word is worth half that of a Muslim. So it's all stacked against them once they get into court. So there is quite a bit of government involvement, but there's also two other problems. One is that there is a close correlation between societal hostilities, where mobs go out into Christian villages and burn hundreds of houses, as they did in Pakistan last weekend against a Christian village on the rumor that there was a blasphemy committed there. And so there is a close correlation. And the other problem is that governments in the Muslim world in particular, Muslim Brotherhood governments, will fail to protect Christians when they are attacked in pogroms by extremists and militants within the Salafi community.
So they may be encouraging it tacitly, but at the very least they're not protecting these populations against these sorts of attacks.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, in Iraq, there were 70 church bombings over the last 10 years. Which has driven out two-thirds of the Christian population. This is one of the four largest Christian populations in the Middle East, or was. The attacks, the bombings, were not carried out by the government of Iraq. They were carried out mostly by Sunni extremists, and the government is, of course, dominated by the Shia community. But that government did not protect them. And these many of the murders and attacks take place with total impunity. No one pays a penalty for that. And we see that over and over again in a place like Egypt.
Our guest is Nina Shea. She is with the Hudson Institute, where she directs its Center for Religious Freedom. And Nina, speaking of governments, where is ours in all of this? Has the Obama administration been actively calling these governments and parties, the Muslim Brotherhood and others, to account, or has it been silent on the matter?
The Obama administration has been utterly silent, deafeningly silent on this issue. We have an ambassador at large for religious freedom. She's invisible. She's been completely marginalized, has really said nothing about any of this. And that includes a very dangerous situation in Nigeria where it could break into a civil war along sectarian lines, and that would be disastrous as a regional power and an oil producer and a large country. Populous country in Africa. So in Egypt, there's been a very Islamist-styled constitution, which the administration has really not weighed in on enough to try to secure rights for the Christian minority, which is the largest minority of religious minority that's non-Muslim in the Middle East. There's an American in prison serving an 8-year sentence, just sentenced in January in Iran, and the administration has really said nothing about that as well.
Yeah. Nina, let me ask you about one other aspect of this, which is really troubling to me, and I don't know if this is directly involved in the study that you've done in your new book, Persecuted: The Global Assault on Christians, but it certainly has a bearing on the ability that this country has to help ameliorate their plight. That is that, as I understand it, these folks are typically not considered to be refugees for the purposes of being admitted to the United States because the UN High Commissioner on Refugees is the arbiter of what constitutes a refugee, and that post is largely under the sway of Islamists who are insisting on Muslims only being considered for refugee status and being brought here in large numbers. Have you looked at that, and is that of concern to you?
Well, we hear of cases anecdotally about that, Frank, and we have intervened and testified on asylum cases for Christians and have won a fair number, including from the Muslim world. But I have heard that there are problems where Christians who have escaped from Muslim countries, like a Saudi person that I know who had converted to Christianity, was actually sent back to Saudi Arabia where he was promptly arrested and persecuted, as you can imagine.
Well, I'm thinking of actually larger populations, where you have large numbers of Somalis or Sudanese or Bosnians or others that are being brought here en masse because they are qualified as refugees and Christians are not. And this really is an extraordinary thing, especially given the problems that are often associated with transplanting these folks here. Nina, we're going to have to let you go. The thing that I'm just so struck by is you touched on a point, and maybe we can get you back soon when the press furor over your new book has died down a little bit, to talk about this, the blasphemy bit, because as you say, Christians are being, in some cases, murdered murdered over false allegations that they've blasphemed against Islam. But at least as worrying as what's coming in terms of efforts to suppress everybody else's freedom of speech, including ours here in the United States, at the hands of the Obama administration and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and so on. We salute you for the terrific work you do at the Hudson Institute, Nina, and of course your past service to the country on the International Religious Freedom Commission. Keep it up. Congratulations on the new book, Persecuted, The Global Assault on Christians, which can be found at Amazon, folks. Check it out. And there will be an event, I know, at Hudson on the 27th of March. We look forward to watching that and supporting your efforts. Keep up the good work, my dear. Next up, Christian Adams joins us. We'll talk about the Islamists that the president, or sympathizer with the Islamists, let me put it that way, that the president seems to have in mind for the next Secretary of Labor. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, that adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Christian Adams, also known as J. Christian Adams, a man I've come to regard as a real patriot. And he has fought inside the Justice Department, and in the years since he left it as a career attorney, for justice. The title of a book that describes the problem as he has seen it is Injustice, and he has most recently come up on the net in connection with a guy who I personally believe has been perpetrating a lot of that lately as the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. And J. Christian Adams, you have warned that this fellow, Thomas Perez, may be a very bad choice for the next Secretary of Labor. That seems to be President Obama's desire. What say you about Thomas Perez?
Well, listen, this guy, Tom Perez,
It's from the Hugo Chavez, Sean Penn wing of the Democratic Party. He is not a liberal. He's not a leftist. He's a complete, total radical. His vision of America is one of racial benefits, of anti-business shakedowns of banks, of a progressive a fantasy world with just radicalized policies. And I could talk about some of those lawsuits that he's involved with, but it's frightening to think that this administration is clearly not interested in reaching across the aisle, because nominating someone like Tom Perez is really a thumb in the nose of people in the middle, even.
Let's talk a little bit about where he comes from. As I recall, he had a career as a kind of leftist, or as you say, radical, sort of champion of open borders and immigration amnesty when he was in Maryland. He then migrated into various elective positions. But talk a bit about his background before he got to justice.
Yeah, he actually, his family fled or left the Dominican Republic and came to the United States. He Harvard Law graduate, and he lives in Montgomery County. He was on Montgomery County Council, Montgomery County, Maryland, which is sort of the very blue suburb of Washington, D.C. And on council, he was notorious for a number of radical policies due to his association with a group called Casa de Maryland, which was essentially an open borders advocacy group that, you know, engaged in social service work for illegal aliens in the United States. And they were against a variety of law enforcement measures like ID cards and, you know, anything to help the illegal was sort of the theme of the organization.
Talk a little bit then about what he has done as the Attorney General's right-hand guy for civil rights. A number of issues that you have chronicled in Injustice, Christian Adams, and elsewhere seem to have his fingerprints on them, or at least he's been implicated in sort of the repercussions of them. For example, the Black Panther business.
That's where we first really saw Perez's skill set, and he came on board after the Panther case was dismissed to do essentially public relations mop-up. The problem was that his mop-up was not always accurate or truthful, and he testified under oath to the Civil Rights Commission to a variety of things, which I write in the book were not accurate, including the idea that only career civil servants were involved in the Black Panther dismissal decision. He said that there was no political involvement. We later find out in a Judicial Watch lawsuit that that was not accurate, and that was not true, that testimony under oath, because there's documents showing that the dismissal went to the highest political levels of the Justice Department,
where he was operating once he took office. And it, I guess the key point on this is, most of you I'm sure will remember, was the voter intimidation that these Black Panthers, new Black Panthers, I guess they call themselves, were engaged in. There was, I guess, what was it, some kind of judicial finding that they were, in fact, guilty as charged, and then the case was dismissed. Why is it, Christian Adams, that as you look at that, as you look at voter ID enforcement, as you look at you were talking earlier in the day about his involvement in transgender education, mandating that, forcing people to engage in it. Perhaps we might talk a little bit about his role in a plebiscite in Guam and who knows what all else. We really see this radical agenda being touted by this fellow. How would this guy possibly perform as a Secretary of Labor, given this kind of track record?
Well, he'll perform as a Secretary of Labor because this president likes the things that this guy stands for. You mentioned the transvestites. He actually was involved in a lawsuit against a school district in New York that told children they can't dress in drag. I mean, it sounds so outrageous to hear that, but that's exactly what it was about. And they sued a school district for not allowing eighth graders to dress in miniskirts. These are boys, of course, miniskirts, high heels, and pink wigs. And this American Justice Department actually brought a lawsuit. He went after South Carolina for voter ID. He went after Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona. He went after Louisiana. He sent people with wires into welfare agency offices wearing clandestine listening devices to see if welfare offices were pushing voter registration. This is a guy who uses the power of government to advance a far left, aggressive, progressive agenda.
One other facet of Thomas Perez's role at Justice that I've particularly found troubling, Christian Adams, is his embrace in the person of a chap by the name of Mohammed Majid, literally, of Muslim Brotherhood operatives and other Islamists. And we've seen this be a hallmark, of course, of the Obama administration to date. But he kind of personifies the practice. This is worrying. In a way, it seems as though there might even be a litmus test now for cabinet picks under this presidency, that John Kerry, Chuck Hagel, John Brennan, the White House chief of staff, are all people who have really gone, you know, overboard, I would argue, in trying to not only reach out to Muslims, but reach out specifically to the Islamists among them. Should that be of concern to us as well in the event that this chap is the Secretary of Labor?
Well, don't forget, this is the same civil rights division that sued a school district in Illinois for not allowing a teacher in the middle of exam periods in December to take the Hajj to Mecca for 21 days. And when the school district said, no, that's too much time in the middle of tests, you're our only math teacher, you can't do this, Perez's Justice Department sued the school district for not making an accommodation. As I write in my book, try that next Easter, if you're Catholic, to get 5 days off to go to Rome. I have a feeling the Justice Department will not be on your side like they were for the Hajj. You know, he travels to Milwaukee all the time to go to mosques. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but there's a question of emphasis. Why so much emphasis? And at the same time, he attacks pro-life protesters in West Palm Beach with federal lawsuits that a judge later dismissed because he said there was zero evidence that they broke federal law, and actually fined Perez's Civil Rights Division $120,000 in sanctions.
Wow. Quick bottom line, J. Christian Adams, former career U.S. attorney, former career attorney in the U.S. Justice Department. Bottom line, what should the United States Senate be thinking about and doing about the nomination of Thomas Perez if it is, in fact, advanced by the president?
Well, if the Republicans in the U.S. Senate don't fight over Tom Perez and stop the nomination, there is nobody they will ever fight over. I mean, this is as bad as it gets. It's anti-business. It's anti-rule of law. It's anti-limited government. If not now, when?
Indeed. And this is one I trust that they will be hearing from you on, and we will certainly be weighing in as well. And we appreciate very much your clarity on this point. Again, the author of Injustice, must read about what has been happening in the Obama Justice Department, by J. Christian Adams. Christian, thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's great to talk with you. We look forward to visiting with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Christian Whiten. We'll be getting his take on Chuck Hagel's marvelous adventures in Afghanistan. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Songer.
Woohoo! Yeah! I had a feeling about this. Uh-huh! I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In recent days, the stench of U.S. defeat has been palpable in Afghanistan. That country's president and America's putative ally, Hamid Karzai, has become increasingly high-handed with our servicemen and women who are serving and, in some cases, dying to protect his government from the Taliban. For example, Karzai has demanded that U.S. personnel stop conducting night raids that have proven effective in identifying and taking down enemy leaders. He's barred our special forces from operating at all in an increasingly contested province near Kabul. And Karzai went out of his way to diss the new Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, during a meeting there last week. Unfortunately, unless we change Afghan calculations, we'll see more of this behavior and more of our troops needlessly killed by Afghans inspired by it. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Adam Credo. He is a senior writer with the highly esteemed Washington Free Beacon. He is a man who has been covering, among other beats, of course, the national security portfolio here in Washington, not least several of the controversial nominees that have sadly now passed through the United States Senate, notably Chuck Hagel and John Brennan. But he's also been covering a developing story, and it's that we wish to discuss with him most immediately today, namely President Obama's upcoming trip, scheduled for the middle of next week, I believe, to Israel and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And what the Palestinians seem to be preparing in the way of a bit of a warm welcome, as I think you put it at one point, Adam. Welcome back. It's always good to have you with us. Tell us what seems to be developing there on the ground in anticipation of President Obama's appearance.
Well, thanks for having me. And you're right. Things are getting interesting on the ground in Israel and in the Palestinian territories. Of course, there's always violence going on, but there seems to have been an uptick in recent days, particularly on Friday during the evening prayers on the Temple Mount, where, of course, the Muslim holy sites are. They were throwing firebombs from inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque up there on the Temple Mount at Israeli security. And, of course, more security had to come in. They were stone throwing. It was quite an episode. But this really should be viewed as a precursor to an Obama visit. Hamas has already said that if Obama visits the Temple Mount, they will see that as a declaration of war. We could potentially see a third intifada. And this could be particularly dangerous because the Hamas and the Palestinian Authority divide is already so high. It's really bad between the two of them right now. They've been trying to get this unity deal. It seems impossible. And the Obama visit could further fracture this entirely.
Interesting that you point to this particular pretext for a new intifada that, of course, was Ariel Sharon's visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as they call it, the Temple Mount, as the Israelis call it, that was used as the pretext for a previous intifada. Although we've subsequently learned, Adam Credo, as you know, that I think it was Mrs. Arafat gave away the game by pointing out that her husband had actually been planning on an intifada for some time. Adam Credo, do you think that that's likely the case today as well, quite apart from the pretext of the moment, that this is something that the Palestinians have been sort of working themselves up to for a while?
Yeah, well, look, I think there's a lot of factors going on here, and you're right, and it's important to put into perspective the fact that a lot of this stuff is planned by leaders. In this case, it wouldn't be the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas, but Hamas, which, of course, controls the Gaza Strip and is always able to rile up its citizens and rile up its armed forces. And, of course, it's even difficult to tell the difference between the two at many points. So what this would be is the Palestinian Authority trying to make sure this doesn't happen and to foment its grasp on the West Bank, and Hamas trying to do the complete opposite. And of course, it's very easy to spur violence there. I mean, it happens at the drop of the hat. But the fact, I think, remains that Hamas is probably planning this, and all the signs are in place that they are, that they've encouraged their youth movements of this nature.
Adam, let me ask you about Obama's purpose in making this trip at this particular moment in time. We've, of course, been hearing for some while now that he anticipated that he would have more flexibility in his second term. Do you expect some of that flexibility to manifest itself in connection with this effort to resuscitate the peace process, as it's called? And if so, how do you think the president might go about that?
Well, look, there's many interesting factors, I think, taking place here all at the same time. There's the peace tract, this peace process that is in complete limbo and has disintegrated over the months and years as Obama, of course, tried to make it a priority early on in his presidency, but that fell by the wayside when he saw how difficult that can be. And at the same time, you have Iran creeping closer to a nuclear weapon and Israel viewing this as its main problem to deal with, being faced with annihilation by a genocidal regime in Tehran. So all of these things are going to come together. It's unclear whether Obama will make a serious push for peace. I'm not sure what he can do in the limited time that he's there, but he might announce a plan. There have been rumblings that he might announce his own version of a peace plan and what it should look like. But I think between Israeli leaders, the main topic is going to be Iran and what Obama can do to assure them that the United States has Israel's back should it need to do something. And it's seeming increasingly likely they might have to.
They do have reason to be concerned about that, needless to say, the Israelis. But Adam, just staying with what the president might be about here, one of the recommendations that his Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, made, as I think it was you among others who pointed out before he was confirmed, in a report from, I think it was the U.S. Middle East Policy Institute, namely that the United States ought to take the lead in the deployment of NATO forces on the West Bank as a means of helping the Israelis evacuate the place and stand up the two-state solution. Do you have any rumblings from your sources, Adam Credo at the Washington Free Beacon, that the president is actually contemplating such a deployment? And what are the arguments for and against such a step?
Well, look, I haven't heard anything concrete that he would, in fact, push for this, at least not publicly. It could be something you see brought up in closed-door meetings. But this is, of course, incredibly problematic for a couple reasons. These forces are already looked upon skeptically by Israelis. They have all sorts of names for the UN in Israel in Hebrew, of course, but all types of funny names really mocking the United Nations, and of course they would be mocking NATO troops as well. But look, the Israelis need to provide security for themselves on these fronts, on the border regions, because nobody knows how to do it as well as they do, and they know what's right for them. And I think to push this would probably be seen as untenable, and when Hegel pushed this, people also viewed it that way at the time too.
Well, it is indeed a crazy idea, but it doesn't keep people from brooding it about from time to time. And I recall back in 1994, Adam Credo, the Clinton administration was prepared and almost undertook the deployment of U.S. forces, not NATO, but U.S. forces on the Golan Heights as a means of lubricating a deal between Israel and the Syrians. One can only imagine how perilous Israel's position would be under present circumstances were they not able to hold that high ground. And the same, I think, is true in the West Bank. We're watching out for a Munich 2.0, as I call it here, Adam, so I know you'll be covering this closely as well. Let me just, in our remaining minute and a half, talk to you about something that your colleague Bill Gertz, one of our frequent contributors here, has in the Washington Free Beacon today. Tom Donilon, the national security advisor to President Obama, has been in Beijing warning the Chinese about continuing their cyber warfare attacks against us. What do you make of that? And are we likely to see any improvement in China's behavior on that count, in your estimation, Adam?
Well, look, call me skeptical, but I don't think we're going to see much. I think the Chinese government is, of course, making the overtures. We all know that they go to great lengths to make pretend, in my opinion, that they're not responsible for carrying out these very, very sophisticated hacks. But whether it's the government or people close to the government, the fact remains that these don't seem to be abating at all. They seem to be increasing, and also increasing in the sensitivity of where they're hacking into, not just companies to maybe steal trade secrets, but of course U.S. government computers as well.
Yeah, indeed. It's a wholesale pillaging. 30 seconds, last bit. We're told that Susan Rice may be Tom Donilon's replacement. Any word on that?
Yeah, look, I've seen these reports as you have too, but it's not incredibly clear to me if that's actually going to be the case. Now, look, we all know that the president likes Susan Rice and wanted her in a prominent position that, of course, she didn't quite seem fit to serve in, but anything could happen with the administration. They went all the way in on Chuck Hagel and won that.
They did indeed, despite your best efforts and ours. We'll hope that Susan Rice will not get this job, because I think she's seriously unfit for it, for the same reasons that she was unfit to be the Secretary of State. But, of course, this one does not require Senate confirmation. Adam Credo, thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's great to talk with you. We'll be talking next with Andy McCarthy. We'll get his take on the Brennan nomination and much, much more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the Southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney.
My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to the Gospel.
I just got
to
stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
And now, for one of the high points of our week, it is our visit with Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor, the man who put away the blind sheikh, who President Obama seems sorely tempted to release. We are also privileged to see his writings frequently in National Review Online and PJ Media. He is also the author of several superb best-selling books, including most recently Spring Fever, now available in paperback, all about the illusion of Islamic democracy. Andy McCarthy, welcome. It's always good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about some musing you have been doing in the wake of the filibuster that Rand Paul, Senator Paul, mounted against the Brennan nomination, kind of, was I guess really the pretext for his filibuster was the Brennan nomination, but it was really all about drones and their possible targets here in the United States. What's your sense of what he was about, what came of it, and what it means?
Well, Frank, I think you're quite right that Brennan, who I think should have been dinged on his own merit, so to speak, was not really the object of Senator Paul's filibuster and other opposition to his candidacy. That was just an opportunity to try to wrangle information out of the Obama administration, and that was directed at the drone program and more specifically the use of lethal force against American citizens. He talked about, in particular, the use of lethal force against American citizens inside the United States based on the possibility that could happen, given the White House's and the Justice Department specifically's extremely broad guideline for when the president had authority to use lethal force. This, of course, is an abstract argument because we haven't had any instances of actual drone use against American citizens or anyone else inside the United States, nor did that be on the horizon. But that was Senator Paul, I think, found a sort of a populist sweet spot where everybody could agree that, at least in this conflict, there was no reason to have authority to use lethal force against Americans inside the United States. So that was what this battle was about. It was kind of, I think it was about much ado about nothing. I know the Paul folk don't like me to say stuff like that, but the fact is that I don't really think that there was any chance that we were going to use lethal force against Americans in the U.S. But
you made the point, Andy McCarthy, in your, as I say, you're reflecting on this in National View Online, that there is a concern that we would see the commander-in-chief effectively barring a constitutional authority that he has, albeit one that it seems unlikely that anyone would want to use under foreseeable circumstances. But talk a little bit about that, Andy, and how this nets out as you see it.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to Senator Paul's idea, Frank, that the administration needs to be reined in, because I think if you look at the white paper, it doesn't really acknowledge any real limitations on the president's authority to use the lethal force. That said, the Constitution is not just for this conflict, it's for every conflict. And while this enemy that we're currently confronting doesn't seem to have the capacity that would necessitate having military operations inside the United States and lethal force used against the enemy here and whatever American fifth column it may have, that's not to say that we could never have a conflict like that. And my problem with Senator Paul's position is I think he's conflating two separate constitutional doctrines. The president is permitted to use whatever force is necessary to protect the United States under circumstances where we're either under attack or there is an imminent attack. He does not need authorization from Congress for that. And I think everybody agrees in that situation, you need to have imminent, at the very least, you need to have an imminent attack for the president to have that kind of authority. Otherwise, Congress is given more power in the Constitution, and it's for Congress to authorize the use of military force to declare war and the like. And my point was that in a situation where Congress has actually declared war or authorized combat operations, enemy combatants can be treated as enemy combatants, whether they're American citizens or not. And we have law in the books that indicates that American citizen enemy combatants, if they join with the enemy, can be, you know, captured, detained without trial, interrogated, subjected to military commission trials, and even executed, as was done in 1942 with a Nazi saboteur who was an American citizen. So my concern is that in reining the president in on imminent attacks or the threat of an imminent attack, in circumstances where the president is kind of acting on his own constitutional hook to react to force, I completely agree with that. But where Congress has declared war and we have an identifiable enemy, the constitutional fact is that it is constitutionally authorized to use lethal force against the enemy wherever the enemy is found.
Really important points, Andy, and I appreciate you developing them at some length here, because I think that it's something that got pretty much obscured in the course of the filibuster and most of the commenting upon it.
And Frank, if you don't mind, if I could make one more point, because I don't want to be skewed any more than I already have been. The Constitution describes in broad terms what can be done. The rule of reason, of course, applies with respect to what should be done. So that, for example, just to be more concrete about what I just laid out, we have an authorization for military force, which is in effect. When Jose Padilla, who was an American citizen enemy combatant who came to the United States to carry out a second wave of post-9/11 attacks, When he walked off a plane in Chicago, he was an enemy combatant. I think constitutionally it would have been permissible to use lethal force against him as he came off the plane. He wasn't trying to surrender at that point. However, the authorities, as they should have, took him into custody because that was the effective thing to do under those circumstances. The courts were open and functioning. The police authorities in the United States were preserving order. There was no reason under those circumstances to use lethal force, even if the Constitution would have permitted it. So that's the point I'm trying to make is the constitutional authorities are there to mass whatever force the United States needs to protect Americans. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you use the maximum amount of your license in every circumstance.
Understood. And I think that is a very helpful and important clarification. Andy McCarthy is, again, our guest. He is a former federal prosecutor, now with National Review Online and PJ Media, also with the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and the best-selling author, our guest each week at this time. And, Andy, let me draw on your experiences in the business of prosecuting such criminals. Let me ask you about this chap, Abu Ghraib, the son-in-law of Osama bin Laden, who is now being brought to trial in civilian court. First of all, your thoughts on the advisability of doing that. And second of all, if you could clarify, are there no grounds for bringing charges against him in a military tribunal under, you know, violation of the laws of war?
Yes, Frank, to answer the second question, there absolutely were grounds to bring him to a military commission instead of a civilian court. That could have been done. As we've noted, going back a number of years to when the Obama administration tried to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to trial in a civilian court in Manhattan, the Obama administration has been trying to undermine the military commission system since the president took office in 2008. In fact, one of the first things he did was pull the plug on the commissions that were then underway. I think that this thing that was done with this character, Abu Ghraib, was designed intentionally to undermine the commission system. Congress has a statute in place that says that enemy combatants can't be transferred from Guantanamo Bay to the United States for trial, because Congress has enacted this, after a lot of litigation with the Supreme Court involved and two trips up to the Supreme Court, Congress has enacted this military commissions system with a, you know, big bipartisan majority. That's the way we've traditionally handled enemy combatants in wartime. The Obama administration was able to end around that with this particular character because he was never in custody at Gitmo. So by bringing him into civilian court, he now gives the guys who are looking at a military commission, KSM and the others who were complicit in the 9/11 attacks, he gives them a great motion to make in court that their prosecution by military commission is arbitrary and unlawful because the other guy is getting gold-plated justice for the same offense.
Yeah, it will be very interesting to see how long it takes the Gitmo bar to get that motion into play. Andy, we'll be looking...
I've about written it for him, haven't I?
You certainly have at least been warning us about it. Thank you for doing so, and always your great work. Keep it up. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.